This is W. Ladson Hinton, 3 February 1992. Darker Sides of the Human Soul.
Dr. Ladson Hinton, Some Darker Sides of the Human Soul, February 3rd, 1992.
See you tonight, and it seems like just in the time since I've been coming here, which is a little over a year, when I was commuting by airplane at first, when I initially came, just seemed like you have such a wonderful and thriving group and such a nice bunch of people, and you're contributing so much to the community, and I certainly appreciate being invited, and it's stimulating to me to be asked to speak on the subject because it forces me to put together my own thoughts and creativity and get me out of my slothful habits. So thank you very much for inviting me. It is difficult to find new things to say about the shadow, which is our topic tonight. It seems so much a part of our common parlance. Jungians and others use the word a great deal. However, there are dimensions that do tend to get overlooked, and hope we can pay some attention to those tonight. The shadow has a way of sneaking in just where we least expect it. We say the word without seeing its deeper implications. My initial remarks will center upon cultural and historical trends that create their own shadows. Following that somewhat factual introduction, I get the facts in first and get on to the more fun things, I guess. I will discuss various psychological and philosophical implications. Lastly, I will discuss a wisdom tale, The King and the Carps, that deals with shadow and transformation of personality. We are never separate from our culture or our tribe. It's like the air we breathe. It is what goes without saying, what everyone tends to accept as reality. Although we know that the spirit of the time is relative, peculiar to one particular little segment of history, the vast majority of people nevertheless live as if the present perspective was a permanent thing. It's so very familiar we take it for granted. This is a limited and biased attitude. There's a propensity to project shadowy threat upon anything which contrasts or conflicts with that reality. Each era, each cultural epoch has its own kind of ethos and its own kind of shadow. The nature of that shadow is especially deceptive because we are all tied in so powerfully with the collective mind. Our initial task tonight is to reflect together and examine that problem as deeply and honestly as we can. I think that our lives and lives of those around us certainly will benefit from such an exercise. We live in a rather conservative time, which to me resembles the 50s in many ways. One sees an endless parade of moralistic concerns expressed in the media, in Congress, professional societies, and a vast array of special interest groups. There is a subtle or not so subtle pressure for correctness in ideas and in personal habits and conduct. In psychological and psychiatric training, as in most fields of study, one finds less and less emphasis on the whole individual. In clinical training programs, there's extensive emphasis on techniques applied to the patient, on psychopharmacology, on the individual only as an element in a system. The goal of these approaches is rational control of the psyche rather than faith in the creativity of the human spirit. In the midst of a particular cultural historical mood, it is all too easy to forget how faddish the human race is. We are pack animals, and the power of the herd as it responds to this or that hunger or fear contaminates every individual member. Our neurological wiring urges us to move with the mass, probably a survival characteristic in earlier times. It does not need repeating how easily manipulated we are in our group existence. either by clever leaders or by the media. They exploit us due to the strength of our fears, whims, and frustrated longings. Frankly, I do have doubts whether one can rationally explain the cultural historical cycles of mood and fashion. It's the case of the blind man and the elephant. However, to be true to the wholeness of ourselves, we must make the attempt to reason and comprehend the best we can. Many factors have contributed to the spirit of our times. The Vietnam War is certainly one. I'm not thinking so much of the rightness or wrongness of the war itself, but of the deceptive way the war was carried out. This led to mushrooming cynicism about the leadership of the elders. In addition, there was exploitation of American idealism to gain backing for the war effort. That happens in all wars, but the extent of lying and deceit in this one caused an especially profound experience of disillusionment. The conduct of our leaders undermined confidence in the elders of our American tribe and resulted in suspiciousness and cynicism about anything sounding idealistic. As a consequence, we feel righteously justified in endlessly belittling the most dedicated public servants. Public life has become an altogether miserable experience, and the best people avoid it more and more. The resulting deficit in both leadership and ideals impoverishes it, thus it's a loss for us all. Another factor is actuarial. The birth rate after World War II was very high, the famous baby boom. The large birth cohort in that generation caused, among other things, an intensified competition for jobs. There are only so many meaningful things to do in a tribe. That generation became a rather cautious and worried one, in my opinion. There was less assurance of position in work and society than for the previous generation. The anxiety of the situation led to hyper-awareness of credentials, an obsession with having the right kinds of degrees, the right kinds of body, the right kind of persona. This is the yuppie phenomenon, and it's not a particularly happy one for those individuals. Yet another factor that contributes to the national mood is the relative decline of American economic preponderance. Whatever the economic origins, the American standard of living has at best stagnated for more than a decade. Combined with the factors I mentioned before, the puncturing of the myth of natural American preeminence in the world has vastly added to our malaise. The fact of worldwide competition and the decline in job security pervades our awareness. We are all products of the Protestant ethic, whether we are Protestants, Catholics, Jews, or Buddhists. Success equals the favor of God in our psyches. Therefore, the decline of American prosperity, the lack of assurance of better material circumstances for the present as well as future generations, has fed a brooding sense of guilt and resentment. We no longer seem the favored of God. That has augmented the tendency toward caution, cynicism, and fear of the future. We have lost assurance of our natural right to a rather prosperous life and a special place in the world, and on the unconscious level, we experience that as sin. A vaguely guilty feeling pervades the national psyche. The AIDS epidemic is an intrinsic part of our everyday lives. It's had devastating effect on psyches as well as bodies. Originally attributed to the sins of a scapegoated minority, the disease now arouses great fear in everyone. It is a common symbol in people's dreams. Patterns of sexual behavior have drastically changed. Even more extreme is the change of attitude. People, gay or straight, take the sexual histories of potential partners and often require them to have tests. Sex has become a very serious undertaking. At the root of this seriousness, of course, is the threat of death. We all know someone or of someone who has died of AIDS. The disease has taken a huge toll on morale and mood. its long and uncertain course with its invariable outcome rips apart illusions of safety. AIDS confronts us all with our mortality. The future seems less secure. This adds to the anxious pessimism of our times. In addition, there is always the danger, of course, of scapegoating, of the tendency to blame Dionysian sexuality for the problem. This projection falls mostly upon gay people, but any nonconforming sexuality seems grounds for suspicion nowadays. In the foreign realm, we no longer have a clear-cut shadow enemy. We all know of the changes in Eastern Europe and the old USSR. No longer can anti-communism bestir the national psyche. However, we remain the heirs of a split view of both the inner and the outer worlds. Persian Manichaeism heavily influenced all the great Middle Eastern religions, including Christianity. We still tend to see life as a war between Ahura Mazda and Ahriman, those ancient gods of light and darkness. We're also a people with a strong sense of entitlement. When there's no great rival in the world to carry the blame for our various woes, what will happen? Who or what will carry the shadow threat for us now? Dramatic scapegoating of racial, sexual, or ethnic minorities or of other nations is always something for which to watch. However, more subtle forms of scapegoating may be the most dangerous. It is where we are most sure of our perceptions, where we feel the most righteous, that the shadow is most likely to creep in. In the Screwtape Letters, a young devil complains to an old one that no one believes in them anymore. The elder sagely replies, "It is just that attitude that makes it for the best of times in their profession. When no one notices, they can run everything." Our most cherished ideas and opinions are the most prone to subtle invasion by the shadow. The power of the collective mind reinforces those ideas and opinions from within and without. It requires a tremendous effort of consciousness to transcend even partially the ethos of the times. I ask you to make that effort and to take up that possibility with me here tonight. I will ask you to look in more depth at the history and tendencies of the human race, and to sit back and reflect upon your pet assumptions about the world. At times, I may play the devil's advocate. I may ask you to question some of your most sensitive issues. Please be assured I'm not doing this in a callous way, but for the sake of consciousness. The authentic life demands that we dare to bring the eye of reflection everywhere. In case I step on some toes during my presentation, I ask your forbearance. Erik Erikson had a great interest in psychohistory. In Young Man Luther, he wrote of swings in the historical mood between license and atonement. To quote, "The first gives license and leeway to sensual enjoyment, to relief and release. The second surrenders to the negative conscience, which constricts, depresses, and joins man for what he has left unsolved, uncared for, unatoned. Such moods overshadow universally available sets of information, finding support for luxurious thoughtlessness at one time, for panicky self-criticism at another. Thus we may say that beside and beyond a period's verifiable facts and official doctrines, the world image breathes." As an example, Erikson cites Huizinga's description of the late Middle Ages. "At the close of the Middle Ages, a somber melancholy weighs on people's souls. Whether we read a chronicle, a poem, a sermon, a legal document even, the same impression of immense sadness is produced by them all. It would sometimes seem as if this period had been particularly unhappy, as if it had left behind only the memory of violence, of covetousness, and moral hatred, as if it had known no other enjoyment but that of intemperance, of pride and cruelty. In the 15th century, it was bad form to praise the world and life openly. It was fashionable to see only its suffering and misery, to discover everywhere signs of decadence and of the near end, to condemn the times or despise them. The mood of our times may not be so extreme as that of the late Middle Ages, but on the other hand, we must be aware of only seeing the flaws in the other fellows. As we near another millennium, the attitude of the times is clearly one of contraction, of self-deprecation, and obsession with the shortcomings of others. The instant a person of substance and ideals appears, he or she gets methodically hacked to bits and smeared with any dirt available. The privacy of the individual is ruthlessly violated in the name of the public good. No one seems clean enough to occupy public office, although it is established historical fact that many of the greatest leaders have had major personal problems. The felix culpa, the fortunate flaw, was once believed to be at the core of the life of the soul. Nowadays, it seems more an occasion for scorn and condemnation. It has always been true that, as in the old French saying, the higher a monkey climbs in the tree, the more its derriere is visible. However, at the present time, it's as if that's all we can see. We live in a time when everyone seems to identify with a specific group of the wounded or needy. It is the fashion. That is not to deny that abuse is all too real and sometimes horrible. Without doubt, one must take a strong moral stance when such violence crosses one's path. What I refer to is a tendency to identify primarily as a member of a wounded group. This identification seems peculiar to the spirit of our times. We see an endless proliferation of seminars, books, television dramas, and talk shows devoted to the subject. It's on everyone's mind. Is the field of psychology itself part of the problem? Might there be a subtle shadow that sneaks into psychological thinking? God forbid. All psychic evolution involves pain. Has psychology taught us to see all suffering and pain as signs of psychopathology? We are incomplete creatures, always in the process of becoming, and we never totally resolve our psychic conflicts. Life is full of rending polarities, and woundedness is an intrinsic part of being human. Conflict indeed forces growth. When you try to eliminate the wound, you savage the creativity of the human spirit. You become an enemy of life in the name of perfecting mental health. It is worth wondering, too, whether the great proliferation of therapists has created a marketing problem. Do we sometimes, in a self-serving way, lead people to believe that the intrinsic pathos of life indicates disease? In that case, life itself becomes a treatable illness. There's an endless supply of clients. Every form of consciousness produces its own shadow, its own kind of unconsciousness. It frequently creates the very evils it claims to despise. One tends to forget that the superego has its origins in the id, the most primitive part of the psyche. Therefore, it retains a strong primitive tendency, especially when it rules the collective psyche. Jungians would call it an archetypal possession or inflation. Dominated by these factors, moral criticism can succumb easily to moral righteousness. The Robespierres and Torquemadas of the world appear on the scene. We see today at least a minor epidemic of such people, and we also experience the collective mood as an inner inquisitor. It is a time of atonement, in Erickson's term. The mood is there in all of us. We always say, "What's wrong?" Usually when you examine your favorite moral cause or position, there is an implied enemy in the wings. This evildoer you oppose often becomes a sort of scapegoat for the wrongs of the world. Whatever the truth or falsity of the opinion you hold, it often becomes a rather closed system that excludes other views of the world. In the extreme, it causes an impoverishment of personality. The tight, pinched face of the fanatic is an all too familiar sight. It's a universally recognizable visage, regardless of cause. It is important to remember that scapegoating is often refined and sophisticated. Religious and psychological groups are among the most adept in this practice. It may be in the guise of labeling anything eccentric as psychopathological, psychology as a religion of the average. The benign arrogance of the saved is similar, whether it stems from religious moralism or the more sneaky psychological moralism. It often seems that the Freudian view casts subtle moral aspersions on all spontaneity by calling it acting out. The peculiarly Jungian form of self-righteousness, which Jim Yandel called to my attention, may manifest in the guise of a deeper-than-thou attitude. Life is an ambiguous business. None of us can fully own the swirling polarities within us. However, the ethical task is to do our best to own the light and the dark sides of our nature and not project the latter upon others despite the temptation of collective moralisms. The greatest danger lies in our own pet causes. It is where we are most sure that we are most vulnerable to the shadow. The best lack all conviction while the worst are full of passionate intensity is a prophetic summary of the times. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. That's from Yeats, The Second Coming. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. That says a lot, doesn't it? There's a Sufi story here that is appropriate. It's called The Man Who Looked Only at the Obvious. I will abbreviate this story, which relates that a seeker after truth, after many, many vicissitudes and wanderings, thought he had found a truly enlightened man endowed with a special perception of things. The seeker begged to be allowed to follow him so he might acquire true knowledge. The wise man finally gave permission on the single condition that he asked nothing about any event he observed, until such time as the teacher himself chose to speak. With that one condition, they set off on their journey. They soon had to make a river passage and were richly entertained by the friendly boat owner. During the night, the wise one snuck below decks, made a large hole in the hull, and then they swam quickly to shore. Once on shore, the seeker could not contain himself. "They treated us royally. Many people may be drowned. Is this the action of a good and enlightened man?" he cried to the teacher. "I told you," said the wise man calmly, "that you always jump to conclusions." I had already forgotten the condition," acknowledged the seeker. He asked to be forgiven, but he remained very puzzled. They journeyed on and finally reached a large and prosperous city. They begged for a little food, but people refused them a scrap and even stoned them. Charity in the city seemed unknown, and the ancient obligation to guests was forgotten. Even wild dogs were set upon them finally. Ragged and faint with hunger and thirst, they had almost reached the exit from that miserable city when they passed a ruined wall. The teacher insisted they stop immediately and repair it. Despite their condition, they labored for many hours until the wall was restored. The seeker was so exhausted that his discipline deserted him again, and he said, "We will not be paid for this. Before we repaid good with evil, and now we repay evil with good. I am at the end of my tether, and I go no further." "Have no fear," said the wise one. "Remember that you said that if you questioned me but once, I should dismiss you. Now you have questioned me twice, and our ways must part. However, before I leave you, I will explain the meaning of my actions, so that perhaps someday you will indeed be ready for such a journey. The boat I sank was thus spared confiscation by a tyrant who was preparing for a barbarous war. One more boat would have tipped the balance in his favor, and the people would have had to bear centuries of oppression. In the city of hatred are two young orphans. When they grow up, the wall will again crumble and reveal a treasure hoard concealed beneath it. That will become their patrimony. They will be strong enough to take possession of it and reform their city, and that is their destiny. Go now in peace. You are dismissed. The ego needs answers. However, what we think we know is much less than what we really know. In order to conduct our daily lives, we require confidence that the world is constructed in a definite way. The old maverick Freudian, Jules Masserman, once called this the delusions of the human race. We need to believe the sun will come up, the grocery store will always be down on the corner, that the unexpected will not intrude, and that death will leave us alone. The ego, a somewhat fragile island in a sea of power and mystery, has a core of shame at its own smallness. Delusions and defenses help us survive the shame before our finitude. They relieve the consequent anxiety and preserve self-esteem. These defensive structures, usually rooted in the vulnerability of childhood, tend to take on the authority of reality. They inevitably narrow perception of self and others to their own dimensions to achieve a comfortable illusion of control. The safe castle we have constructed becomes a prison. We no longer see the rich dimensions of all that is. Does our aimless blindness doom us? Or are we, on the other hand, stuck with a life of vicious relativism? There is a stance in life which transcends this dilemma. The demanding moral task is to face life in all its ambiguity and individuality. Only in this way can we avoid the twin horns of blindness and cynicism. There are no easy or collectively given answers to the larger problems of life. In fairy tales, there is no one solution to the problem of how to deal with the evil one meets. One may fight with it, run from it, or sit in the woods and meditate on it for 20 years. The meaningful solution is always dependent on context. It is individual. Here I equate ethics and the effort of consciousness, the endless task of respecting life and all its singular uniqueness. The essence of the moral life is to own our subtle and gross darknesses and not scapegoat others. It is necessary to acknowledge with what subtlety the shadow intertwines itself with our best aspects, those very qualities in which we take the most pride. We must see and acknowledge all this, and yet not fall into a pit of equally shadowy cynicism and despair. The transcendent thread of joy and meaning is the reward of a truly conscious life, although it is the pearl of great price. To see life in its strange mixture of splendor and horror, to see and know it all, and yet to affirm it all, too, amidst its ambiguous mystery, represents the highest possible ethical achievement. I quote Erickson's eloquent comments here again. There are always islands of self-sufficient ardor, on farms and in castles, in homes, studies, and cloisters, where sensible people manage to live relatively lusty and decent lives, as moral as they may be, as free as they may be, and as masterly as they can be. If we only knew it, this elusive arrangement is happiness. In Mysterium Conjunctionis, Jung states, all true things must change, and only that which changes remains true. Life is, in essence, constant movement, combination, dissolution, recombination. Deep shadow problems usually involve a basic fear and hatred of this endless, ambiguous flux, this ongoing dance of polarities. The shadow is the dark possibility of change. It can be an inner phenomenon, an experience of projection, or most often both. It reflects the ego's intrinsic fear of real or potential change. It is the dark brother or sister carrying the unknown future. When a person has been wounded deeply during childhood, and all of us are wounded to some degree, there's an inclination to see movement and change as dangers. There's a tendency to split life into polarities to make life seem safer and simpler by owning only one dimension of reality and projecting the other. The certain, simple, and predictable give the illusion of safety. The person sees the natural motion of inner and outer life as threat. The result is a constant war against the life within or without. Any hint of darkness or ambiguity must be controlled, compartmentalized, held at bay. Anything short of perfection, which equals predictability, appears to be dangerous. The superego wars violently against the basic nature of the self and its constant evolution. Since the essence of life is change, perfectionism is at root a hatred of life itself. In Man and His Symbols, the last publication before his death, Jung warned of misoneism. Fear or hatred of the new was one of the greatest dangers to individuation. Such an attitude would seem to justify the most extreme atrocities. In Dostoevsky's The Grand Inquisitor, the Inquisitor imprisons Jesus for being a disturbing influence on the human race. The Nazis intended to purify Europe with their policies and programs. In the name of saving America, Senator Joseph McCarthy and his followers ruined many lives and careers in the 50s. Many years ago, I saw a brilliant man in analysis. He was highly successful in his intellectual career, but from the everyday human point of view, his life was a disaster. His marriage was in a shambles, and he had no friends. There were constant conflicts at work. He entered analysis because he was in a classic midlife crisis. The reality of his existence had exceeded his capacity for denial and rationalization. An interesting and significant symptom involved thousands of dollars of photographic gear that he never used. He stored this equipment in sealed containers and worried obsessively that dirt or moisture would somehow leak in. He fantasized endlessly about the photos or movies he might make. However, he never took anything out of its case. The equipment, like his imaginative vitality, remained compartmentalized and unused. He conducted a constant war against moisture and earth, the taints of real life. There was a matching constriction of his emotional life. He was an extreme perfectionist, and he was miserable. There isn't time to go into the details of his analysis, which was relatively successful. What is important to our discussion is a basic image that emerged after many months. This was the image of an Egyptian pyramid, a tomb, everlasting in its purity and perfection. Each precious object was always and eternally in its place. At the root of his obsessive perfectionism was the image of the tomb, the necropolis. This image revealed his fear of and hatred for life and led to a myriad of rich insights. Behind the mask of perfectionism, he found a secret worship of death. We later referred to it in our work as the necropolis ideal. What is the alternative to such a plight? This man found his way to a more vital and spontaneous life. He started to use some of his camera gear and sold the rest to take an exotic vacation. His view of life changed as he faced the tormenting wounds of childhood and adolescence. He stopped oscillating between an inflated sense of superiority and terrible feelings of emptiness. As time passed, he increasingly embraced existence and its rich ambiguity. We run into the necropolis ideal every day of our lives. We are constantly making the choice whether to embrace life as a whole or defend against it. Every day, we fall into little defensive inflations, which are anti-life at their core. It may lurk in the secret arrogance of so-called high standards, which symbolically keep inferiors in line. Creative personalities frequently experience criticism and moral censure because they threaten the established order. To quote Eric Neumann, the disastrous influence of true criminal personalities is matched by that of only one other class of people, the radical idealists, dogmatists, and absolutists. Nero and Cesare Borgia are in fact rivaled only by Torquemada and Robespierre. Now, in the last part of my presentation, I'm going to relate an East Indian tale that I mentioned earlier, The King and the Carps, which some of you may have read. It's from the book by the same name by Heinrich Zimmer. After you've heard the story, which I will give you a little synopsis of it, I will amplify our insights into the shadow side of human nature by discussing some of its dimensions. Once there was a king who sat every day in state dispensing justice. Each and every day, a holy man in the robe of a beggar or ascetic would offer him a fruit. The royal personage accepted the trifling gift and passed it along without a word to his treasurer. The treasurer then tossed it over his shoulder into the vault without a glance. The person would then withdraw. One day, a monkey escaped from the women's quarters and leapt onto the arm of the throne. It playfully took a bite from the fruit the holy man had offered, revealing a valuable jewel therein. The king's eyes grew wide, and he asked his treasurer about the other fruit. They went to the vault and discovered a mass of rotten fruit in various stages of decay. Amidst the pile of decaying fruit, the debris of many years, was a heap of priceless gems. When the ascetic appeared the next day, the king refused to accept his gift unless the ascetic paused to speak. The holy man requested an audience in private. He told the king that he needed the help of an intrepid man, a hero, to assist him, an enterprise of magic. The stranger further invited him to come on the next night of the next new moon to the great funeral ground where the dead of the city were buried and where criminals were hanged. The king agreed. On the appointed night, the king came to the ghoulish place full of a tumult of specters and demons. Fearlessly, he continued on his way and at last found the sorcerer, intently drawing a magic circle on the ground. "Here I am," the king said. "What can I do for you?" The other hardly lifted his eyes, saying, "Go to the other end of the burning ground, and you will find the corpse of a hanged man dangling from a tree. Cut it down and bring it here." The king did so, and the corpse fell, giving a moan as if injured. Thinking there might be life in it, he began to grope over the rigid form. A shrill laugh came from his throat, and the king realized that the body was inhabited by a ghost. "What are you laughing at?" he demanded. The instant he spoke, the corpse flew back to the limb of the tree. The king ascended and again cut the body down. He lifted it without a word this time, placed it on his shoulder, and began to walk. He had not taken many steps when the voice in the corpse began to speak. "O king, let me shorten the way for you with a tale," it said. The king did not reply, and so the spirit told him a long and complex story that involved deep moral questions. The specter demanded an explanation at the conclusion of the tale. "Who was guilty?" it demanded. "If you know the answer and do not reply, your head will burst into 1,000 pieces. The king knew the answer, which had to do with the unconsciousness of the particular king in the story. He suspected that when he told the answer, the corpse would go flying back to the tree. However, he did not wish to explode. When the last words of the explanation had been spoken, the carp's groaning in mock agony vanished from the king's back and hung again from the arm of the tree. The king went back to the tree, cut the carps down, shouldered the load, and tried once again. "My dear sir," said the specter, "you have encumbered yourself with a difficult and curious charge. Permit me to while the time away with a story." The sequence of events repeated itself time after time, always with the same results. All the tales involved subtlety of moral discrimination. The king was able to answer each time, except for the 25th and last time. The last tale concerned the case of a father and son. They were members of a hill tribe of huntsmen, the father a chief. They had gone out on a hunting party when they happened on the footprints of two women. The father was a widower and the son as yet unmarried. The footprints were especially charming. The practiced eyes of the hunter suggested they had been left by a noble mother and daughter, fugitives of some aristocratic house. The larger prints hinted at the beauty of a queen, and the smaller ones the fascination of a princess. The son was much excited and proposed the father should offer marriage to the woman of the larger footprints and himself to the smaller, as befitted their rank and age. The chieftain had to be persuaded, but at last he acquiesced. The two took a solemn oath that that was the way it should be. They made haste along the trail and came at length upon the two unhappy women, a queen and a princess indeed, in anxious flight from a situation that had developed at home when the king had unexpectedly died. They were overjoyed at their rescue. However, there was a complication. The daughter was the one with the larger feet. According to their oath, the son would be forced to propose marriage to the queen. Indeed, they returned to the village and married as they had sworn. The daughter agreed to become the wife of the chief and the mother of the wife of the son. Then both the women conceived. Now, just how were the two male children that were born related to each other? Asked the voice of the specter in the carps. Precisely what was each to the other, and precisely what were they not? The king, carrying his burden, was unable to find any unequivocal term for this complicated relationship. He walked along, bemusing the problem in silence. The children would be living paradoxes of interrelationship, both this and that, uncle and nephew, at once on the father's side and the mother's. But is it not always so with all things in some secret way, the king thought? Is not everything also its opposite? He mused that even though the discriminating intellect, the categorizing logic of human language and thought may refuse to accept the paradoxical fact, every feature of life includes, nevertheless, qualities diametrically opposed to those implied. He walked on in silence, pondering his own character, that in the kingly personage there can lie concealed a secret unkingliness that may lead, for example, to inadequate supervision of possibly dangerous strangers, or perhaps a tendency to underestimate gifts that arrive in humble trappings. Similarly, unholiness can reside beneath the robe of a religious mendicant. The king walked on in silence, pondering, and apparently the specter was impressed. Sir, it said, you seem cheerful in spite of all this tramping back and forth across the funeral ground. You seem unafraid. I am pleased by the spectacle of your determination. You may have this corpse, therefore. Take it with you. I'm about to quit it. But that wasn't the end. The specter became serious. Listen, O king, the specter warned. That beggar monk is a dangerous impostor. With his powerful spells, he is going to force me to re-enter this corpse, which he will then use as an idol. What he plans to do is place it in the center of his magic circle, worship me there as a divinity, and in the course of the worship, offer you up as a victim. You will be ordered to fall down and do me reverence, first on your knees, then prostrate in the most slavish of devotion. with your head, hands, and shoulders touching the ground. He will then attempt to decapitate you with a single stroke of your own sword. There is only one way to escape. When you are ordered to go down, say, okay. All right. So it says, there's only one way to escape. The specter says to the king, when you are ordered to go down, say, please demonstrate this slavish form of prostration so that I, a king unused to such postures, may see how one assumes such a position of worship. And when he is lying flat on the ground, strike off his head with the sword. In that instant, all the supernatural power that this sorcerer is trying to conjure from the sphere of the celestials will fall to you. The king returned to the sorcerer, who was patiently waiting. He prepared the ritual as the corpse had predicted. When the monk performed the posture of worship, the king struck off his head and then rolled his body over and split his chest, offering the heart with the head as an oblation to the specter of the corpse. A mighty sound of jubilation rose up. The specter, too, lifted its voice in joy and praise. The king was given dominion over earth in this life and power over souls, ghouls, and spiritual presences when his life on earth was ended. The king, too, asked that the 25 tales be made known over the world along with the story of the night itself. The specter promised, in addition, that Shiva would protect everyone from spirits and demons when the tales were told. Then Shiva appeared in all his glory and bestowed on the king with his own hand the divine sword invincible that should give him sovereignty over the world. And then he lifted the veil of ignorance that had been concealing from his consciousness the immortal essence of his human life. Blessed with this illumination, the king was free to take his leave of the burial ground. The dawn was breaking as he returned to the spacious halls of his lordly palace, as someone awakening from a night of troubled sleep. The tales of the specter had been like a succession of tortured dreams, seemingly endless yet comprised in a brief period of time. The victim, caught in the interminable sequence, walking to and fro across the burning ground, had been like a sleeper tossing restlessly in his bed. Just as one may discover on awakening that what had been obscure the day before is now understood, and was much more profound in its obscurity than one had supposed, as obscure as the riddle of life itself. So this king came from his experience full of knowledge and transformed. At the beginning of the tale, the king seems devoted to the ideal of the perfect king. He patiently holds court every day, available to his people. However, there is a hidden flaw in his awareness. He fails to question the unusual person who appears before him every day. He fails to look at the gifts the stranger offers. Our routines, our most reassuring habits, tend to conceal the jewels hidden in everyday experience. We miss the infinity hidden in the grain of sand. Look into the ideal of kingship, holding daily court in the regular and reassuring habits of our lives, we lose touch with the deeper levels of existence. Kingly perfectionism seduces one into smug self-complacency. We fail to see, feel, or hear the vital singularity of the life around us. The monkey escapes from the harem. The feminine side of the psyche presents something new, like a deep upwelling. The spontaneous trickster spirit breaks the spell of kingly perfectionism. In everyday life, a mood, an unexpected accident may do the same thing. When the psyche starts to play tricks, when the unexpected intrudes, it is crucial to listen. Indeed, the king does listen. He is able to stop and pay attention to the unexpected. He demonstrates an exemplary willingness to follow the inevitable, to embrace his fate. That is the true test in life. We all meet surprises and disasters, inner and outer. We can never fully anticipate the future. Consciousness is always imperfect and incomplete. What we do with the messes that occur is the measure of personal maturity. To many, abrupt surprises are anathema. They represent a threat. Such people will go to great lengths to maintain the status quo. Life tends to become more and more ossified and dominated by vague paranoia. Any potential agents of change are the enemy. At root, it is a quest to make life be still and perfect, the necropolis ideal. We get many second chances, however, like the king. It may also be that we need the quiet discipline of routine to prepare us for the next set of inner and outer challenges. It is noteworthy that the king, rather than falling into a state of narcissistic woundedness because of his oversights, becomes curious. These are the times of testing in life. Will we fall into a state of self-indulgent deflation at our failures, or follow the hidden thread of meaning buried in the unexpected? Will the ambiguity of life seem overwhelming and cause us to withdraw in fear and dismay? This is the moment when a shadowy dread of the unknown can cause paralysis of will and failure to take the next step in individuation. The unmonkish monk is a parody of the king's unkingliness, the defect in his wisdom and perspective. To take up the challenge is to enter hell. When something shatters our comfortable defenses and routines, there's hell to pay before we attain the hidden jewel. It is necessary to endlessly carry the dead baggage of wasted years before redemption can come. It is like the incessant rehashing of the past and analysis, which can seem never-ending. All the tales told by the specter, the riddles, are stories of oppositions with various outcomes. The ego must learn there is no sure prescription for right behavior. Tales will say stand and fight or do nothing, sit and meditate. There's no general solution for life's deeper questions. It's always a matter of context and timing. The solution can come only through empathic connection to the concrete circumstances of life. It is necessary to live into one's own answer. We are all fools when it comes to the crucial junctions of life. We can never know the outcome of our choices in advance. Indeed, the king does at times seem a fool. He goes off alone into a dangerous place. Surely his advisors, the guardians of collective protocol, would have counseled him not to go, or at least take a small army. When change is in the air, frightened inner and outer counselors may be obstructive. Any change appears dangerous in their eyes. However, the king seems not to know, knows not to seek such advice. He embraces his fate unreservedly, and that shows the intrinsic nobility of his nature. The answers to the riddles come to him simply and directly. When a conflict is authentically embraced and born, the simple integrity of a situation most often becomes clear. We usually wonder why we didn't see it sooner. This clarity comes in an instinctual way, like a helpful animal in a fairy tale. Such uncomplicated integrity is the rare gift of some personalities, but difficult for most of us to achieve. It appears to be the gift of this king. Great patience is required in the task. Indeed, the name of the false holy man was rich in patience. Jung was fond of saying that the main ingredient of change was patientum. The word patient implies the attitude necessary for healing. In that light, all transformation, all individuation involves moral choice. Will one willingly suffer conflict without succumbing to cynical depression or reactionary inflated perfectionism? The platitudes of conventional psychology can be a real obstacle here, for they often label continuing painful ambivalence as pathological. All of us tend to want quick solutions, but if we seek results too quickly, the transformation process fails. The specter in the carps, like the specter deep within us all, notes everything. Our bad faith to life does not go unnoticed in the depths of the unconscious. The more perfectionism and denial, the more the individual disowns the shadow, the greater the unconscious burden of guilt. The inner specter may become gigantic. Efforts to get rid of it often become frantic. The need to scapegoat may become extreme. The king, however, accepts his fate without blame. The right attitude is everything. It is such moral choices in life that test us most severely. Will we seek a shadow cause of all our problems, blame somebody or something, or dare to affirm life in all its richness and ambiguity? The king's ultimate test is the story of an insoluble knot of relationships. The women, the feminine, turn out differently than expected. The chieftain and his son highlight the limits of the rational mentality. They must accept and live with the situation they created, which represents metaphorically all of life. But life itself is like this knot, an intertwined maze of circumstance which reason can never fully grasp. The key in this last story is the king's humility in not answering, not judging, just to be judging. It is difficult in life to admit one does not know. Forbearing action, resisting the illusion of rational closure, leads to the king's redemption. It is very crucial to know when not to act. The lacunae of silence leave room for another dimension to emerge. Here it is the specter who comes forth as the savior rather than the holy man. By carrying that macabre entity faithfully and patiently, by having a respectful dialogue with it, the way out becomes clear. The burdens, trials, riddles, and tortures that life brings may cause us to feel pervaded by a sense of putrefaction and death. We must bear it faithfully, even if our precious assumptions about life collapse into a pile of putrefied garbage. It is only by willingly suffering this torment and finding our individual answers, the answers that come from the deep core of simple integrity, that we transcend the field of death and misery. Only through suffering the negredo, the large and small dark times of the soul, can we shed the reactionary defensiveness that paralyzes creative life. As we have seen, perfectionism can be ever so subtle in its array of tempting guises. The allure of certainty is always great. Above all, we would like to evade the pain involved in transformation. The final act of the king goes against all conventional morality. He must become a trickster and violate all social protocol. Indeed, he must behave quite diabolically. This is a theme one often sees in tales that deal with evil. At times, one must be cold and ruthless, as cold and ruthless as nature, von Franz was fond of saying. This truth applies especially when facing the most regressive infantile parts of oneself or of another. In such situations, a clear and absolute confrontation may be necessary. Mere goodness in the collective sense may make things much worse. In the end, the key is always discernment of the clear inner voice, the transcendent thread. One finds it only through accepting and suffering the ambiguities of inner and outer life. The right attitude when confronted with these contradictions is crucial. It is all too tempting to succumb to the negative inflation of narcissistic woundedness, to an equally inflated perfectionism, or an endless vacillation between the two. In conclusion and summary, I reiterate how crucial it is to diligently discern the spirit of the times. It is the sine qua non of a conscious and ethical life. That is because every age has its own peculiar tone and prejudices. The present era seems insecure, preoccupied with its fears and sense of woundedness. It is one of those times when the collective mood sees potential change as threat. We look for the causes of our discomfort. The scapegoats may be ethnic, racial, or sexual minorities. It may be other nations or peoples. Deviant individuals, be they gifted eccentrics or the truly mentally ill, are viewed with suspicion. Innovation is feared rather than welcomed. An ethical life requires the difficult task of consciousness. It is the most demanding challenge we meet. To see and accept the contradictory nature of the whole of human reality, most especially our own, takes courage and every ounce of our will. The effort is excruciating and exhausting at times. In reaction, we crave a more perfect world, an end to this constantly moving, ambiguous mixture that constitutes our existence. This longing often translates into a hidden hatred of life. We project the shadow, we scapegoat others according to the spirit of the times. It is so much the fashion we hardly notice. It's an injustice to others and a severe obstacle to personal evolution. Inner union will not occur unless we respect the individual essence of life around us. Our lives and our vitality will remain trapped in sterile, frantically defended compartments. We may have clever personas that speak the language of individuation, but not truly individuated selves. Through perseverance and ruthless self-examination, one can attain moral perspective. Clarity is possible, though rarely permanent. The effort to gain and regain a moral stance is never ending, but commitment to the process gives meaning and vitality to life. That is the true basis of individuation. The path of transformation requires facing and embracing our contradictory natures. It requires actively affirming life as the fertile and fascinating mess it is. Otherwise, we march under the banner of the necropolis ideal. Thank you. But it's clear that most people, I think, do their best, and it's just astounding, and I've done it over and over again, how we indulge ourselves in this sort of shadowy pejoratives that we put out there. I don't care what political party it is or anything else. That I think if we start at home and take our projections back, I think that's the first step. You know, everything always starts, I think, with one's own consciousness.
Well, that makes some sense to me, because the myth kind of is that there's leaders that are somehow operating in some sort of separate realm, like in a vacuum or something.
Yeah.
That a leader can't lead without support.
That's right. Now, I grew up in a very political family and met, you know, people, senators, congressmen, kind of, they're just stumbling along, and even the worst ones, I think, a lot of times they're mostly trying to do their best. It was my impression. I knew some who did some very bad things, actually, but they did it because they were so unconscious, not because they really intended to do anything that terrible. So, yes, there's no one out there in some rarefied other stratum that somehow is plotting and all that. I think it's almost like a paranoid fantasy. It's a symbol of how helpless people feel, I suppose. People tend to feel helpless, but maybe more so somehow at this particular time in history than some others. Yeah. Anne?
I resonate a lot with what you have to say because of my interest in Yeats and a lot of the more lively, colorful people. But there is a deep acceptance in some of the writings, particularly Yeats, of all of life, which I think you're alluding to. And when we move into those perfectionistic or self-righteous categories, we simply miss life. We miss it. I can remember a comment Joseph Campbell made in a lecture to a young woman in which she stood up and said to him, I spend a lot of time meditating, I fast, I go through all of these purifications, this is my path. What do you have to say about that? And he said, well, I just think you've missed all of life.
Yeah, no, Yeats is the, you know, he's my favorite poet, so favorite. You know, he was the epitome of embracing life as it is and affirming it over and over again, descending into hell and in the midst of hell, climb back out and reaffirm again and again. And, you know, it's a wonderful example of just what I was talking about, trying to talk about. Yeah, I think the person, too, that you mentioned, he said something to someone who'd done all the meditation and everything. I think meditation is wonderful, but it can be kind of a destructive thing also, a kind of a tyrannical sort of superego makes a person even feel more guilty in very strict forms that they have natural human emotions and flow of life. I think that's a kind of a Asians have told me that's a particularly American kind of Christian perversion of a lot of the meditative disciplines, but I think it can be a real problem. If it's a path to the soul, but I think it can be, certainly meditation is wonderful, prayer, meditation, reflection. But I think the way some people use it, and I see this frequently in people I work with, and actually someone I saw many years in analysis is now writing a book on the subject, is how the sort of an image of the perfect balance person without emotion, without attachment to anything becomes sort of a tyrannical inner ideal, a kind of a perfectionistic thing in the terms with which I was talking about it. I mean, I love meditation. I've meditated for, I don't know, I mean, how long? Over 40 years.
Meditation can be simply sitting on a riverbank, the arm, looking out, walking along a street and looking out at the sea, or enjoying the sunset. It doesn't have to be
Oh, I don't want to knock meditation. I don't want to knock meditation. It can be used or misused like anything else, you know. It's, if it gets into that perfectionistic thing, that's when it's deadly. That's just the point. And you do see that particularly, I find, with young people who kind of use it as a way of escaping from life rather than embracing life and plunging in. It's kind of an excuse to withdraw from an impure world rather than just living, and then maybe getting to an age when meditation might have a truer meaning, I think. So I don't, it's complicated. No, I love meditation. So I can see you do. Stillness, yeah. Very good point, Marla. That's well put.
I'm going to frame those things.
Yeah, I'd like to send me a copy. Sounds great. Somebody in the back there.
You used the Vietnam War in your description of some contemporary, I guess, effects of the shadow. Do you think that, or how will we move beyond the
I guess I'm not sure that I agree. I feel like there was more openness in this war probably than most wars myself. I mean, whether you agree or disagree, and I myself don't, you know, I could see either stand being justified 10 years from now, but I feel like there was quite a bit of openness. There was a lot of preparation, there was a lot of sense of the experience, and there was a, as Kimbrough Bashir mentioned to me, a ritual of return, and the whole, there was a ritual sequence in this war that I think will make it much easier on the psyche, you know, whatever you think of the rightness or wrongness of it, whereas Vietnam was just snuck up on us. I was in the service during part of the war, and new intelligence officers that were high up and were being told to lie and saw the draftees pulled out of college and they'd come back. That was in Europe. They were brought back as wrecks, and there was never any open acknowledgement in a way we were at war, and there wasn't any ritual return. I think it was drastically different than the Iraq War myself, and I don't feel that that war will, personally, I don't feel that will take anywhere near the toll on the psyche that the Vietnam War did. I think it was conducted quite differently. I mean, there are always imperfections, but I don't know, it's a matter of opinion. But I see it as being quite different. Yeah, if we hadn't done anything, I mean, I think you really have to admit, I mean, at least I have to admit that I don't know. It was a messy business either way, for sure. The identification is wounded or abused. Oh no, I don't see it as contradictory. I was seeing it as merely descriptive, that it's an unusual, it's a distinctive quality of our period in history that people tend to identify primarily in that way. Not that we haven't always had wounds and always talked about pain and suffering, but that people think of themselves primarily as belonging to as a sort of a main collective identity, somewhat to the exclusion of more positive things. Say, like, if you go back to the 60s, people were talking about experimental lifestyles or what people could do here and there, and there was a lot of irresponsibility, but, you know, people certainly didn't ever talk about that sort of thing, although it was going on just like it always has all through history, you know, suffering and pain and so forth. But that in this particular time, and I really don't know the reason, it just seems like there's a large preoccupation with that identity. No. No, I was pointing out merely the danger that whatever the spirit of the times, there's a tendency to look for scapegoats, and when you identify primarily as wounded, you're looking for a cause of wounds, and I think with all the things going on at this time in history, there's a danger of, as I said, subtle scapegoating, a kind of conformism, fear of the new, fear of anyone or anything that's different. There's danger of scapegoating, I think, minorities. Who knows what kind of wars could be cooked up. But I see this wounded state as a primary sort of identity as being a danger of conjuring up a shadow of scapegoating, looking for who's responsible. Is it a compensation? It could be, could be.
What you see is the effects then on the collective later on, the result of
it. Could be just a part of an endless cycle, sure, that there was neglect of those problems, and now, you know, it's like, I tend to think that way, that these are just sort of almost impersonal cycles, and we think this is the way it's always been, but, you know, we're much less free than we think, you know, that we're just, the cycle lives somewhere deep in the unconscious of the human race. Kimbrough?
You talked about the attitude of the 15th century, and
Yeah, the rotting of the 15th century was the beginning of the Renaissance, exactly. Good point. Yeah, I think that's a very good point. The 15th century, the rot and the putrefaction and preoccupation, and I feel that myself. I feel already a kind of, I'm an optimist by nature anyway, but a sense of something new, that people are kind of, there's something new coming about. I just get hints of it in people's dreams, I think, and just in my general feeling about society these days. I think, and the Renaissance, of course, was a stormy time, and it was full of crime and lawlessness, and yet, wonderful, exciting, and creative. So, I agree. I like that idea. Rotting for a purpose. There's always a purpose if you can find it. And I think ultimately, too, we can only have our own individual renaissances. We have to face this all within ourselves and take the Yeatsian model and the firm life, Look at all this smelly business and live our lives fully. Then nothing stops us from doing that. It's only our illusions and our fears. Well, Plato, he had the idea of the horses pulling in two different directions, but the later Plato was really almost a hater of life, that he even wanted to ban poetry. He became the early Plato of the dialogues, it was like a love of the life process, of the dialectical process, and then after the death of Socrates or whenever, he bought into the pure idea, and he became kind of a hater of existence, in my opinion, almost the necropolis ideal, and he adopted the ideas of the Pythagoreans and mathematical certainty, and so it depends on which Plato. The early Plato, I would agree, the later one, is a really kind of a fascist character, of the Republic and after.
But he believed that the form was just where the absolute truth is. But
right.
He did caution everybody to say, you can't get it.
Yeah, it would depend on which Plato. The early Plato, the dialogues, is wonderful, embracing life. The later one's kind of creepy to me. I think he became a very embittered man, for what happened in Athens at that time. Well, it looks like everybody's about tired out, I see. So thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.